minded, but you know, his take on it, I think, was sort of, well, you know, because he'd been around for quite a number of years now, with, you know, the climate's always changed, and you know, he thinks it was different. You know, when he was a kid, he remembered, like he was telling me, hotter summers, and I was just sort of curious whether, you know, in your experience, you found perhaps also that, you know, the older generation might be a little more skeptical about it than the younger, or that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, I think it's mixed. I mean, I think there are different issues for different age groups.
Right.
And I think, you know, for younger people, you know, who are being taught this stuff at school, because of course it wasn't taught, you know, older generations, it's easier for them to assimilate it, partly because all their social group believes it as well, and so you're more of a nutter if you don't believe it than if you do. Whereas for older people who, you know, members of that tribe who don't believe it, aren't that well educated, often, particularly older white men, very heavily invested in it in terms of their careers, the part, you know, who wants to hear that their whole life work has contributed to, you know, pushing our civilization off a cliff? No one wants to hear that. So there are a lot of issues. So some of it's to do with what information people have got. If they've been taught, you know, the world is just, you know, up and down, and we've lived through these things before, and history doesn't change, it's just more of the same, you know, climate's changed before, there aren't these huge, scary thresholds, then it's much harder for some of those older people to... The psychological challenges of assimilating this information are harder. There's no question. Anyone else?
Do you think science fiction has got a positive role to play in how people understand what the future may be?
Yes, definitely. Absolutely. I think there's even a new genre around climate. I can't remember what the technical term for it is, but, you know, consequences of climate change being, you know, written out in science fiction. And some of it's quite dystopian and bleak. So it can be positive and negative, but there's no question that stories and narratives have a huge, huge impact.
Because I've mentioned it to Sam a couple of times, that cartoon film Wall-E about the space robot that goes around cleaning stuff up. Mm. And I watched it one night because there was nothing else on TV.
Sure.
And then I watched Toy Story. But it's one of the best things it's one of the best movies I've seen in recent times because of actually what the message is behind it. And these, you know, fat human beings that can't support themselves moving around on chairs, and the world has just become a great big rubbish tin.
Yeah.
And that's the sort of thing where you think in your head in a futuristic sense.
Yeah.
But is that the level that you need to bring it down to a cartoon for kids or adults?
Yeah, I do.
I should get a message.
Yeah, well, I mean, the narrative is critical. The form it takes can be very different, whether it's, you know, cartoons or films or story or whatever. But you're absolutely right. The narrative and the kind of vision that's painted is huge. You know, it can be very compelling. It can be very bleak and repellent. And, you know, it can be very scary. And I think what social psychology is telling us is that scaring the hell out of people actually doesn't work that well. Because unless there's an alternative vision of possibility, unless there's another narrative that people can grasp and work towards, then what are you leaving them with? You're just sort of scaring the hell out of them and then leaving them with nothing. And this is why so often you get this feedback saying, oh, you want us to go back and live in caves? You know, who wants to do that? You know, like, nobody wants to do that. So there's got to be a vision that's better than, well, we just got to reduce our emissions and go back to a simple lifestyle and, you know, all grow veggies. I mean, that suits a certain subset of people, but no one wants a gardener, no one wants to grow veggies. You know, people have very different interests. Our society is much more complex, our education is much more complex, we've all got different gifts and talents and want to use them in different dreams. So there has to be another vision that is compelling and that draws people, another narrative that's hopeful and, you know, fuels people's imagination and energies and creativity to try and build something that's not going to push us off a cliff, you know, something that's better than we than the other possibility. So you've hit on a critically important issue.
Yep. Home and Away, the new sustainable city. I've had a look at the website, I think it's fantastic.
Which one?
The Fallacy.
Yeah.
it just strikes me there's a lot of skill and effort people put in to protect their biases.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just, and I'm sure I'd do the same thing, and I know a lot of people do the same thing. So yeah. It's really good self-reflection.
Absolutely. You can,
but then what are we, we're down to like statistics, it's pretty bland. Man. It's also a lot of fun sometimes.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, issues are pretty serious.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, it's just, if we're just dealing with, if we don't use any of these things, then we're just using facts.
No, no, not just facts. But yeah, I mean, a good point. Because, yeah, being aware of these things, so what's left? I think that being aware of these things and being self-aware of the ways in which our brains can trick us and our, you know, clinging to a certain identity or, you know, can trick us is critically important. And that's, again, I'll get onto why the spirituality is so important, because, you know, allowing for that process of reflection and integration. And one of the things I'll mention, no, it's not just about facts and prose and that kind of dead stuff. It's about much more than that. But yeah, in terms of discernment of information, yes, it, those are things that help us discern what information is more reliable than others. So, but
to back up your spiritual position, or to help
you know, clear your glasses. You know,
yeah.
But in terms of the where you go from there and painting a new vision, a new narrative, that's not just about facts and prose. That's about spirituality and art and creativity and story and vision and all those things like that come from all of us, not just our heads.
Not bias. Isn't that all those things?
Well
also a bias?
Well, they can be, you know, I mean they can be. This is why you don't just get all the right information, then forget about all that stuff and then go and build your vision. You know, you've got to be mindful, keeping aware of the possibility of those biases and fallacies while you build your vision and build your alternative. And you can use different forms and so on. But yeah, it's not something that you just forget about. But neither does it leave you only with barren facts, I suppose.
Humans are so diverse. If everyone cleared their logical fallacies and cognitive biases, we'd still have different views.
Yeah.
We'd still have...
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah.
And all of that stuff, which is a lot about the paradigm shifts and those sorts of issues as well.
Yeah.
You don't have to be necessarily interested in sustainability, for example.
Mm.
They're just bloody good business critical things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Skills.
Yeah.
You could use for any process.
Or you know, just general, you know, life.
They shouldn't be taught, as critical thinking, logical thinking skills anyway.
Yeah, and I've just scratched the surface of those. I mean, as you saw from that poster, there's a bunch of others a bunch of other cognitive biases as well, which are all kind of useful to be aware of.
Can I just say one quick thing?
Of course.
I know we're moving on, but I think that understanding that you yourself have confirmation bias and amongst professional biases and whatever it may be is great. Mm. But realising that in someone else or helping someone else realise that is probably a key to our future.
Yep.
Because it's the fact that we are such complex creatures, we all have our own opinions, but we fight against each other as if one is more superior than the other.
Absolutely.
And that's what troubles me the most, and I work in the Indigenous health space. That's the thing that I constantly butt up against.
Mm.
I don't know everything and I'm as wide as they come. So being talking on behalf of some Indigenous communities can sometimes be tough in getting my credibility across.
Absolutely.
But it's just the fact that I'm asking you to listen, and that's really, really hard.
Mm. Yeah, mm. No, that's exactly right. Thank you. All right, shall we go on? This is, you know, having just talked about fallacies and biases and creativity and these other things, now I'm going to talk about some facts. Just reality check on sustainability. Now, Jeff's, I know, gone through some of this, so maybe old hat, but have you seen this diagram, this wheel, sustainability boundaries? This is one published 2009. It's been updated a bit, but it's basically showing us about nine...
I showed the updated version.
You showed the updated version. Jeff's onto it. Right, good. So you've seen this. We've blown through some of those boundaries, including biodiversity. We're in serious danger of blowing through the climate change one. This... the one problem I have with this diagram where it talks about climate change is it's basically talking about the effects that we've seen so far. And what it doesn't really give an adequate account encounter, I don't think, is the lags that we've already locked in to the effect we've already locked into the system that we haven't seen yet. So I think we're actually much, much, much closer to blowing through the threshold than this diagram gives the impression of. But yeah, so those are some of the problems we've got.
I was trying to be an optimist, right. Just coming along.
Sorry. This is, I want you to have a kind of a reasonably close look at this one. This is, I'm an ex-geologist, so this is one of my favourite ones. This is a diagram of, so it's been stitched together from different studies. It's basically Earth's temperatures, global surface temperatures roughly, from 540 million years ago on the left up to the present on the right. So you can see, so there's a zero... This is a problem with too many screens. There's a zero line about, you know, sort of quarter of the way up from the bottom, which is sort of pre-industrial temperatures. You can see in the past, particularly on the left side, during, you know, dinosaur times, all that, where temperatures were, you know, lower than they are now and much higher. This blue squiggly band here, particularly, this is a kind of log scale. It expands, it's much contracted on the left and then expands out on the right, okay? So these squiggly bands, particularly here, around the Pleistocene, towards the right, these drops are the ice ages, okay? So you can see the ice ages are only, you know, 3 or 4 degrees below global average surface temperatures now, okay? That's what gave us the ice ages. This is one of the critical facts that a lot of people just aren't aware of or don't get or choose to ignore in the public debates. So that people sort of say, oh, you know, 2 or 3 degrees warming, how bad could that be? What they don't understand is that, you know, 3-4 degrees below where we are now didn't mean you needed to rug up a bit when you went outside. You know, it meant you might have a mile of ice over your house if you're in the north.
Which meant you had to rug up with
your Okay, so this is what people just don't get about, you know, when we're blasé about whether or not we're going to blow through 2 degrees warming, 3 degrees warming, oh, maybe 5 degrees, you know, that'll be nice and warm.
But that doesn't seem to come out in the argument for climate change, that fact that, because it's always talking about how warm it's going to get, a negative result, or to give some perspective on what it means.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's never, I mean, it's the first time I've ever heard that.
That's why I always talk about it when I talk about climate change. Yeah.
It's always about the warming, and you don't get any actual perspective to someone to go, shit, really?
Yeah.
And yeah, that's quite a powerful thing to say, the opposite.
It's fairly important, yeah.
But so whose fault is that?
Brits.
I need to try harder.
And that's why I use that example of core temperature for a human.
Yeah.
That we're not just talking about it was 10 degrees yesterday, it's 20 degrees today, it's 40 on Sunday, we can survive.
Yeah.
But it's our core temperature. And, you know, a couple of degrees C, and you're in dangerous fever territory.
Yep.
And so, which is sort of the equivalent, but a different way of saying it.
But maybe politically and, you know, through society, that's where it's missing. That could be a missing link for, you know, millions of people to actually grab a reality check on what it means.
Yeah, well,
so
I think
it's, I mean, it's, you can't point a finger at one group of people, but maybe the lobbyists, you know, ACF, whatever, those are the types that may be able to do. Because the politicians are the sorts that would bury that sort of thing. So how are you going to get that?
I talk about it all the time. Other people, I think, do. One of the problems is people don't want to hear it, because of all those biases and stuff we've talked about before. But yeah, you're right, it's critically important. So just to give some context, yeah, you may have, who's heard of the medieval warm period? People heard that in discussions around climate change? Yeah, it's what the climate skeptics will say, it was warmer during medieval times. And yes, it was warm during medieval times in parts of northern Europe, but it probably wasn't global. But the medieval warming period is kind of, warm, then we had a little ice age. I talk about Little Ice Age. Little Ice Age was bugger all in the 1600s, 1700s compared to what the actual ice ages were when you had miles of ice over some of those places. So Little Ice Age, it's kind of playing with words a bit if you want to call that an ice age. You know, it was pretty cold for a century or so in Europe, but it wasn't anything like the previous ice ages. Now, the take-home point from this is that what when we talk about 5 degrees potential warming by the end of the century, that is that line. Basically, in geological terms, essentially straight up, instantaneous geological change of temperatures that we have not had for more than 40 million years, the Eocene optimum. And that's when humans, early humans didn't develop till a couple of million years ago, or a million years ago. Eocene times of horses, well, the ancestors of horses, were about the size of a small dog. Okay, so 40 million years ago, we haven't seen those temperatures. It was a different planet. Entire, you know, continents have moved since then, since that time. The Himalayas have, you know, evolved since then. Entire species have evolved since then. None of our systems, none of our ecosystems have ever seen anything like 4 or 5 degrees above where we are now. But that's what scientists are saying we're heading towards by the end of this century, unless we dramatically reduce our emissions. Where are we heading currently? I'm going to try and do this. I'll see if I can make this.
You want technological assistance? I reckon we might. Who wants to put some money in? I'm going into the shorts business, shorts and t-shirts.
This is a computer model developed by the Met Office in the UK, given to me by Dave Griggs at Monash. It's basically tracking the. This is a model of the temperatures from the mid 1800s till the end of this century. Global, and what I want you to notice about this is the difference between average global temperatures and the big blasts of heat you get across the continents. The oceans tend to be cooler, continents tend to get much hotter. These are the big effects that wipe out entire rainforests. You know, they burn for months and months and months, and you can't stop them. Like Indonesian forests burned in '98 when they had the big El Nino. But you see, over time, you know, it's very variable. You get still blasts of cold. But over time, the temperatures ratchet up. Now, this A1FI emission scenario refers to the previous IPCC report, the sort of business as usual scenario in terms of fossil fuel production. So that's what, this is projecting what would happen if we just kept on business as usual. So you can see now 2020s, it's getting quite warm. You're starting to get huge heat waves over the big continental land masses. You're getting less blasts of cold up in the Arctic. If you look right up in the Arctic Circle and Antarctica, you're getting a lot of heat. Right up around the tundra, huge blasts of heat across Africa and the Amazon.
Can you show the scale a little bit? Can you move the
I don't know how to do it. Okay. So this, and history doesn't stop at 2100, of course, it keeps going. Yeah, you've got. Those are the effects at 2100, but then you've got a whole lot of momentum built up in the system that hasn't manifested yet at 2100. Okay. So this is why all the climate scientists that I know are just beside themselves. You know, they've sort of operated on an idea for 10, you know, 15, 20 years that if we can just get more facts out into the public, if we can just make people understand how serious this is, then we'll get political change. But it hasn't worked, because the social psychology and the political psychology is much more complex than just putting facts out there. One of the cognitive biases that scientists have, because they've gravitated to that profession, they think that other people think the same way, and they don't. This is one of the problems. This is another cognitive bias that affects scientists. When you know too much about something, you forget.
It's like a marketing communications
problem. It totally is. And it's a social psychology problem, yeah.
That's right. And I mean, Fred highlighted, because he said, you know, because he started in geology, etc., this was one of my favourite graphs. Mm. When you showed that heat graph,
yeah.
I suspect the rest of us didn't look at it and think, gee, that's one of my favourite graphs too. that's really a boomer.
Right.
You know,
so
right. I had to be in that field to want to do it.
Yeah. Okay, so this is a paper that came out in 2012. It's online, so you can have a look at it. Global warming's terrifying new maths. It's relatively short, so if you want a reality check, I'd strongly recommend you have a look at this paper, because Phil McKibben, who founded 350.org, basically breaks it down. I mean, these numbers have, you know, been updated a little bit, but the broad picture is accurate. So 2 degrees. This first number. This is the most conservative estimate of dangerous climate change. Pretty much all the scientists I know think that's much too high, and it's going to, you know, we're going to see really serious problems well before 2 degrees. But politically, that's what, you know, governments are sort of aiming to say they're aiming to keep warming under.
Can I just add? Yep. You said before probably around 0.8°C above pre-industrial already.
Yep.
In the system, there's debate about, yep, that, because some have recalculated and want to put it higher than that already.
Yep.
And possibly 0.5, 0.6 or something.
Yep.
In the pipeline, in the, yep, lag.
At least 0.6, yeah.
So, you know, we're talking 1.4, 1.5, something like that,
yep,
if we stop farting today.
Yep. 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 So this is why we can't, you know, wait until 2 degrees. We've got 2 degrees because of the momentum, it doesn't stop. So 565 gigatons is the amount of CO2 that could be released in the atmosphere and still have a reasonable 80% chance of staying under 2 degrees. Current rate will use that budget up by 2028. 2,795 gigatons is the amount of CO2 that would be released by the combustion of current fossil fuel reserves. That was 2012. The value of those fossil fuel reserves, 27 trillion, roughly. Okay.
And that's by 2028 as well.
No, that's saying what the, in 2012, what the current fossil fuel reserves were and how much CO2 would be released if they were all burnt.
Right.
So, the take-home conclusion from that, given the difference between the second and third number, is that something like 80% of existing reserves can't be burnt if we want to stay under 2 degrees. This is what's fueling the massive divestment movement away from coal, away from fossil fuels. This is what's fueling the panic in some of the fossil fuel companies. This is what has huge implications for our economies, for pension funds, for, you know, the people, you know, got all their money invested. You know, this $27 trillion is, you know, it's a lot of money, and some of these companies, they're not going to give it up easily. So this is why some of them are fighting tooth and nail against any move to rein in climate change, because then this is one of the problems where you can get individual rationality and collective psychosis, because individually it's rational for each one of those companies to say, okay, this may all be true, but we're going to make damn sure we burn our reserves and maximise our shareholder value, make sure our company is the one that survives. So individually it may be quite rational. The problem is you get every company doing that and then we're just completely done. Okay. So it's a global coordination problem. It's not going to be solved by individuals, individual actions of companies. It's got to be solved in terms of coordination.
There was a study I didn't talk about last time because there's too many studies, and, about the possible consequences and costs of massive global sea level rise if we lose Greenland ice shelf, Antarctic ice shelves, etc. And the figure, this was London School of Economics, I think some folk there, talking about net present value costs of something like $60 trillion.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they're, I know, big, we're bringing it back to dollars, which is...
They're big numbers.
But, you know, we're talking unbelievable damage.
Yeah.
And, of course, humans are caught up in all that, yeah, as well. Somewhere.
Yeah, so basically these companies are valued by the kind of current psychology of the markets. But I think it's entirely possible and probable that it could well be at some kind of tipping point in terms of the psychology that produces a quite dramatic reduction in the value of these assets as people realise that they just can't be burnt. You know, a lot of people know that now, but most people don't. So, yeah.
So is a solution to pay countries not to pull out their natural resources? If there's an economic benefit,
yeah,
to exploiting the environment, until there's an alternative resource that's commercialized, mm, level, and we need them to keep their...
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's one of the live options being debated. And so, you know, paying Brazil not to cut down its forests,
yeah,
for example, palm.
Within the model,
yeah,
that's a quick solution.
It is. It gets very tricky ethically, particularly because these issues have been known about for 30 years. I saw something on my Facebook feed today, documents emerging from Exxon from 1982, where company scientists were aware of climate change, and they even gave a figure of something like 80% of fossil fuel reserves needing to be left in the ground in 1982. So there are difficult ethical issues with rewarding the stupidity and psychosis of companies that have continued to make massive investments in these things when they knew they were dangerous. What?
Aren't we beyond?
Well, no, but it's complex because you have to sell it. If you're going to do something as a democracy, you've got to sell it to the public. And so there are tricky things with the appearances of rewarding companies or individuals. But at the same time...
Well, they've done it in a way, it's like banks have been bailed, because the issue would be that... the argument letting would be the potential damage that's going to happen if it continues the behaviour.
And you also... it's kind of a reality check all round. This is where we are, and so what's the best way to make massive emissions reductions quickly? And so, maybe providing face-saving ways for companies or executives or whatever to get out of this and to choose a different path. Do whatever it takes to enable people, companies, to choose a different path. A bit like some of the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions in South Africa or some of the stuff happened in Rwanda, they didn't. At some point, you've got to draw a line under history and say we need to move forward into a different vision. Not if we decide to get bogged down in recrimination and blame, then we're stuffed. Because people, if they only know they're going to lose from the changes, they're going to dig in. So you're right. It's really tricky.
We understand the issues.
Yeah.
We've been talking about it for a few days. So we're oppressed. What we don't have much is a takeaway of how we ought to live, how to make a difference. I mean, the book you referred to, Ishmael, it says man isn't fundamentally flawed, he just doesn't know how to live. So, I mean, I think that's where the challenge and the opportunity is, to give people a template of how they should be living and the choices they should be making regarding these things, if we're actually serious about I mean, this is the fundamental issue.
Yeah, I agree.
What's the answer? That's what we all want.
It's in my pocket. Yeah. Well, I'll talk about some ingredients for that. Okay. So, let me bolt through this because I don't want to get bogged down on these facts. No. I'm talking to Jeff. let me bolt through this so that we can have a discussion about some of the more solution-oriented stuff, okay? So, but I do want to, because it is important that we hit some of these key things so that there's a shared understanding, because you may know, but others might not. So this is a task. This is from 2009. It's basically looking at the historical link between CO2-related emissions on the left axis and GDP, cumulative GDP production on the bottom axis. So it's basically, up till 2007, a huge amount of our production has been based on fossil fuels, increasing fossil fuel in billions of tons of CO2. We have to massively ramp that down. And if we don't want to collapse our societies, keep the value of our production growing. Tricky.
It's very ambitious.
Yeah. I'll go through this very quickly. The economics of this stuff is often done just terribly. The US government put out a really useful interagency report looking at what's called the social costs of carbon. It's basically, for every ton of CO2 we emit, how much damage does this do globally to the economy? Measured in dollars. Okay? You may think, well, it's a stupid exercise. In some levels it is. But it's also quite enlightening to get a rough feel for what those numbers might be. So this is done in 2013. I did a bit of work in this a couple of years. This is from last year. But what that's showing is coal prices and the damage being done per tonne of coal burnt. So you burn a tonne of coal, get roughly 2.8 tonnes of CO2. Factor in all the assumptions about the damage. basically, you can see that, you know, a price of coal at that stage was, you know, thermal coal was $80-something, metallurgical coal was 100 and something. It's gone down since, I think. But you can see that the damage, in terms of the range of estimates, and it gets, the damage is much higher as you take into account fat tails and lower your discount rates. The damage is much higher than what they're actually selling the coal for. So they're selling the coal for, you know, 80, 100. What? Anyone know what the price of coal is right now?
$40.
Roughly. Yeah. Well, it's really low. Okay. So the price, since we did this analysis, the price of coal has gone down. Australian dollar's gone down. So in Australian dollar terms, the damage figures are much higher. So they're basically, we've got these huge mines shipping out this coal. It's all doing all kinds of, you know, damage to our economy and helping a lot of ways, but globally the damage from that is much more than what the price of coal is. So there's that. The other thing is that those damage estimates are actually very, very conservative. This is from the Journal of Economic Literature, which is on the top.
$42,
yeah. See, so it's much worse than what I had written. So the damage estimates in those models are very conservative, because this was a review that was done in 2013, I think, in Journal of Economic Literature, basically saying the economic models are too simplistic, they don't take into account nonlinearity, thresholds, all that stuff, and the climate science was too conservative. So the damage is much worse than even those figures, which showed that digging coal out is crazy.
On an economic basis.
On an economic basis. In terms of thinking about the IPCC, we mentioned this earlier. Even if you don't, if you're not a climate scientist, and I don't think any of us are, you have to decide on this issue who you're going to trust. And the people that you're dialoguing with, your boards, your employees, they have to decide where you're going to put your trust in this. You know, in the Australian newspaper, Herald Sun, what? Think about, if you don't know anything about the science, just have a think about the incentives that those different groups are facing. Okay? I think that's useful. It's always a useful exercise to think about the incentives of different groups. Climate scientists, if they could disprove a link between greenhouse gas emissions and climate change, what would they get? They'd get a Nobel Prize, lasting fame, thanks of a grateful world, huge research grants. Their centre would be internationally famous and lauded for 100 years, okay? Because they were the one that killed the beast. They knocked over, you know, this problem that was panicking the world. Okay, so the incentives, rather than, you know, because the deniers always like to talk about, oh, climate scientists are on a gravy train. You know, they just get more grants. Think about it for a nanosecond. That's insane. You know, if you're a supporter of the consensus, it basically means you're in with the other 99% of climate scientists all saying similar things, trying to compete for the same grants. But if you can prove conclusively that the link is bollocks between greenhouse gas emissions and climate change, then that's a Nobel Prize for you, no doubt. On the other hand, if you're a fossil fuel intensive industry or company, what's at stake for you? Hundreds of billions of dollars in future revenues, higher asset stock prices, increased ability to attract and retain talented staff, improved brand image, so on and so on. They have huge incentives to try to disprove the link between greenhouse gases and climate change, and that's what they've done. So, but it still hasn't happened. It still has not happened. In fact, the consensus has grown much, much, much stronger over the last 30 years. A lot of you may not remember this. In 1990, the Liberal Party went to the federal election with a platform to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by at least 20% by the year 2000. John Hewson took that policy to the 1993 election. Okay? So you guys who think, I mean, or your friends or uncles or whatever, family think, oh, you know, scientists don't agree about this, you know, it's really difficult. Bollocks. We're the victims of a massive disinformation campaign that was launched, you know, 20 years ago. There was a scientific consensus, even back in 1990, strong enough that the Liberal Party took this to the federal election. Huge backlash since then. There's lots of books there. You can give you the references if you're interested. Basically a massive propaganda campaign. The results of that we've seen play out, particularly even in the last month, with Abbott being deposed, but the right-wing conservative think tanks basically took it upon themselves to try to push this message of denialism, which meant that the field of constructive engagement around solutions was basically vacated by the right and left to the centre and the left. So they've been the ones talking about solutions for the last 20 years, and the right basically just, we can't hear this, you know, la 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 la, you know, it's not happening, and you know, chose instead this big disinformation campaign. And that seeped into our political culture and seeped up right up into highest echelons of our government. You know, with the conservatives basically locking themselves into an anti-science view, which I think was catastrophic for them. If I was actually, you know, a thoughtful conservative, I'd be hugely worried that my political, you know, home had wedded itself to an anti-science view, because you're never going to win like that. You win in the short term, maybe, but I think Abbott being deposed has tipped the balance on that. So, gets back to, you know, who are we going to trust?
Donald Trump.
Yeah. Okay, so Nationalist Academies of Science, where everyone has said climate change is a massive issue. I love this quote from Carl Sagan, you know, said, because they always say, oh, you know, maybe we like Galileo. In fact, there was even a Galileo Society or something that Alan Jones, I think, was involved in. So Galileo, of course, is the, you know, Italian scientist who was persecuted by the church when he wanted to tell people that, you know, the sun didn't revolve around the earth. That was the other way around. But, yeah, so Carl Sagan said, you know, they laughed at Galileo. They also laughed, you know, they laughed at Newton, but they also laughed at Bozo the clown. Just because you're being laughed at doesn't mean that, you know, you're right, and that you're some sort of secret genius. That's just a little, you know, graphic displaying, you know, roughly how many deniers there are compared to actual, you know, other climate scientists. It's even smaller than that now, I think. But this is not, so appealing to the IPCC and these National Academies of Science, that's not a logical fallacy on appeal to authority, because it's because of the way that consensus has emerged. It's not just a matter of political debate or religious debate. People have taken a vote and come to a position and therefore have the authority. It's not that. It's the accumulated weight of 30 years of evidence. So that's why it's authoritative. Almost the last slide before the next section. But so where are we now? This is a bit hard to see, but this report came out last month. It's saying, what are countries taking to the Paris climate negotiations? So what has Turnbull locked himself into, potentially, in his deal with the Conservatives to get their votes to topple Abbott? He's locked himself into a position. Australia's up the top in the pink, and the pink means worst, well, the dark pink means worst among developed countries, and light pink means Australia's in the worst three. So our position among developed countries is one of the most horrendous. And so Turnbull's now in an extremely difficult position politically, and it'll be very interesting to see how that plays out. But we are, you know, there used to be debates about saying, oh, you know, why should Australia be in the lead? We were never in the lead, but we're nowhere close to being in the lead. We're in the back. We're playing the role of spoilers in the international negotiations.
China?
Oh, this is just developed countries, you know. But China's actually doing a hell of a lot. Now, this, again, I want to return to this issue of what's responsible and what's extreme. And this is related to, you know, how the debate's conducted. You know, no one wants to be an extremist. It's related to these two issues, this anchoring and what's the middle ground. I talked a little bit about that before. But it's basically, people don't want to be portrayed as extremists, so they will adopt a moderate position. Well, what exactly is a moderate position on not wanting to return to the conditions we had 40 million years ago by 2100. What is a moderate position on that? What is a moderate position on whether or not you should respond to an invasion fleet coming over your horizon? What is a moderate position in extreme circumstances? It's not the slow, gradualist, you know, we'll get there in the end approach. So, you know, who are the extremists in this debate? interestingly, the government has just published a warning. I don't know, how many of you have seen this stuff that's come through in the last couple of days? The government published a book about de-radicalisation and the problems of radicalisation. And one of the case studies they give is of a woman they call Karen, who fell in with a bad crowd, started off, you know, a gateway drug of environmentalism, being concerned, you know, maybe she was in a class like this, she got, you know, upset about it all, and she started chaining herself to bulldozers, damaging logging equipment, so on and so on. But then gradually she saw the error of her ways and became a nice middle class girl. And this is just come straight from the government. It's like pure propaganda. It's extraordinary. But again, the logical fallacy is, you know, here is kind of middle ground, saying, well, you know, the appropriate response to an extreme situation is to be moderate and, you know, work within the existing frameworks and structures and be a good girl. There's a parody done on Jesus. I know you can't read the writing, but it's interesting. It's basically saying, Jesus saw the error of his ways. I'll just read the last paragraph. People were occasionally healed and so on, but there was a beginning of a transition out of radical activism where Jesus struggled to recover, define his identity and his role in society. Over the next few years, he took on new hobbies, made new friends, gradually restored contact with his family, learned Greek and Latin, and now works broadly in the public policy field. Jesus explored his beliefs and adopted a more moderate theological and political worldview. He now thinks that collaboration with the ruling authorities is the only way to produce long-term solutions. Jesus regrets his former involvement in activities that could never have changed the world for the better, and is now committed to working with the military occupation to effect incremental changes for people in the occupied territories. Very well done, whoever did it. This has just come out in the last couple of days. There's Martin Luther King on the right. He says, never, never be afraid to do what's right, especially if the well-being of a person or animal is at stake. Society's punishments are small compared to the wounds we inflict on our soul when we look the other way. Which gets us to the next bit. Why does spirituality matter, even if you're an atheist? And this is where we can start, you know, talking about solutions. Where do they come from? Opening that space up. Our worldview, spiritual worldview, fundamentally affects our understanding of our place on earth and our society's place on earth. So, you know, traditional one, if you like, I mean, it's a broad brush caricature, but I think it's got a lot in it. You know, broad idea of, you know, human beings at the top, everything else underneath us. So it doesn't really matter how we treat animals or the environment or forests or whatever, because there's always more. It's an endless frontier. For a while that was true. But in actual fact, we are realizing way too late that we are embedded in an ecosystem. You know, we are a part of that. I heard a wonderful comment from a man named Brian Schwimm, who said, the earth was once molten rock and now it sings operas. Well, it sings operas through us. You know, we've emerged. And so we've emerged, you know, with particular capabilities, but it doesn't mean it's that we're top of this hierarchy and can do whatever we want, because it's going to bite us on the butt.
Ishmael,
yeah. This is a different perspective on, you know, traditional, you know, religious theological views. It's saying, you know, there is a sense of divine presence in all living things. That's one view. And if you have that kind of view, it changes your whole thinking about a lot of this stuff. Talking about poetry versus prose, we talked about, it's not about just brute facts. I want to read that poem just for a few seconds. What we're learning through social psychology and 20 years of trying to convince people with facts is that people are not moved by facts, mainly, on the whole. You know, we're very complex beings. We're part of tribes. We have particular spiritualities and worldviews and psychologies. And the things that move us are poetry and stories and songs and art. Subset of people are moved by facts. But if those facts are such that absorbing them would put you outside your tribe or force you to change your whole worldview, those facts are very difficult to absorb. So in terms of communicating a new vision, you know, solution, sustainable solutions and so on, we're not going to do it by just facts, by reports, by plans, by and even this applies to your businesses as well. You want people to catch a vision of where you want to take your business. You can't, it's not just going to be communicated by writing it down in a bullet point plan. That's not how we function. Economists, you know, have, for 50 years have sort of relied on the assumption that we're rational beings, and but basically we're not. It doesn't mean we're always irrational, but we're more than rational, and the stuff that really moves us is not always just prose and facts.
It's the same thing that happened when the Franklin Dan thing was on. There was a pop song that
yes.
The Franklin flow, and that's where it really took off.
Yep.
Exactly.
One of the things I'm really involved in working on is this idea of sacred activism. It's this overlap between spirituality broadly defined, and by that I don't just mean, you know, adherence to a particular religion. I mean what our worldviews are, what drives us fundamentally, how we make meaning out of life, what we think the point of life is. That's what spirituality is. Economists have this phrase, revealed preference, right? And it means you don't survey people and ask what they prefer. You watch what they do and how they live their lives, and that reveals their real preferences. And it's the same with spirituality. I'm not really particularly interested in what people say their religion is, what their cognitive beliefs about cosmology are. What matters is how they live their life, how we live our lives, because that reveals our real spirituality. You know, if you make your career basically working horrendous hours till you're 60 and neglect your family and, you know, and make money your god, then your life will reflect that. So the spirituality is critical. Sacred activism is important because it helps understand the role of worldviews in spiritual evolution. So understanding the different kinds of people we're dealing with, different kinds of worldviews that we're coming up against, the different tribes that are out there have very different views on these things. It seeks transformation, not seems to become the majority. So it's not about just expanding our movement interested in sustainability to try and get 51% or 70% or whatever you need for a supermajority and replacing their set of thugs with our thugs, better thugs. You know, it's not about that. It's about seeking transformation of the system, seeking transformation of the people and calling people to their highest, calling people to their better and nobler selves, if you like. So it's understanding also the crisis of sustainability is at root a crisis of spirituality and meaning, and people being on this treadmill where they are caught in systems where they have to work, they have to pay these mortgages, you know, they have to adopt certain lifestyles because of the system that we're embedded in. I've talked about speaking not just in prose, but those other forms. Also, I'd say it's beyond simple self-interest. Jeff and I have discussions about this. I think it goes beyond self-interest, but we can talk about that. The last thing I want to mention, spiritual practice is essential for personal transformation and sustenance. And I don't mean just going to church or temple or mosque, and that can be part of it. But even if you're an atheist, you know, a huge amount of research now on the benefits of mindfulness and meditation and reflection, taking time out, you know, being aware of what's going on inside us, being aware of where we're disconnected, being aware of our worldviews, being aware of our cognitive biases, what, you know, the traps we fall into, being self-conscious of the goals we're making for them ourselves, being self-conscious of, you know, cognitive dissonance, Vikram and I were talking about that before, you know, being self-conscious of the things that we cannot let ourselves know because the consequences would be too difficult for us, you know, all those kinds of things. So taking those times out for reflection and spiritual practice is essential as well. And also, you know, for managers, activists, whatever, you know, if we're not nurturing and sustaining ourselves that way, we burn out and flame out. We get disconnected over time and slowly burn out. You can come back from that, so it's not the end. Don't worry about the detail. Again, this is just a model. There are many models out there of psycho-spiritual development, though, so the evolution of people, of individuals, of social groups, and where, you know, their characteristics. And it's important to be aware, I think, of these kinds of models of how people can progress, how groups can progress, because it affects your communication strategies. It affects, you know, the types of narratives you might tell, you know, the media and so on. But it also affects broadly your strategy. I think one of the big problems with the green movement is that it's sort of afflicted by a worldview that if only we could give people more information and convince people to be more like us, that then we'll be okay. You know, it's like an incrementally persuade more people, just convince more people, give them more facts, and here's a new report. And there's a value, there's some value in that, but people are diverse. We have however many different models of personality types. We have many different personality types. We have people interested in all kinds of things. So we have to create, it means we have to create structures and incentives so that economically people face incentives. So even if they couldn't give a rat's about climate change and don't, or sustainability, and don't believe in it, they still are facing incentives that lead them to make choices that are good for the planet and society.
Who gives you your tier rating?
Oh, the one on the left is from Ken Wilber's work. He's a integral theorist. If you look up Ken Wilber integral, you'll find tons and tons of stuff. Ken Wilber, W-I-L-B-E-R. I think some of his stuff is useful, and I mean, it's all just modeled. You know, I mean, these are models of very complex things, and but I think it's useful to be aware of stages of psycho-spiritual development, both for yourself and for your companies and for the people you work with, and because it affects strategy, it affects communication, it affects expectations, affects what solutions are possible. That's what I'm saying. It's critical to understand this in designing solutions, because if you think we're going to get solutions by just persuading people or giving messages that only appeal to people perhaps further along the psycho-spiritual path, it's going to fail utterly. The solutions have to encompass people at all different stages and different personality types.
Can I? Which is one of the really great things about this whole thing is, I don't know whether others see this, but potentially this challenge will lead us to be much more real and whole people and communities.
Yeah.
Whereas there's a huge amount of evidence that says a lot of us don't feel real or connected in our world. We're sort of the outsiders, the chameleon outsiders, looking in on something that's happening. Now, it doesn't mean we're all just going to sit around campfires and sing songs and hold hands. Yeah. Although, except for the campfire, which releases, there's probably some advantage. People want to be connected. Two are not as as disconnected as at one side.
Well, but that's precisely why we were talking before about why it's so difficult if a certain tribe has a worldview of rejecting climate science or that there's any sustainability problem, why it's so difficult to reach people who are members of that tribe. Last slide. Don't lose hope. we can talk, there's a lot about solutions as well. We can talk about the plunging costs of solar. We can talk about there's huge amounts of innovation going on as well. But I suppose what I wanted to emphasise today is just not only the facts, if you like, that I know Jeff's talked to you a lot about, and I wanted to hit some of those particularly just to cover them again, but also to talk about the some of the essential concepts we need to understand about systems that we may not even think to look for, but also to be much more mindful and conscious of our own cognitive biases, tendency to fall into these fallacies and so on, both for ourselves and for our people we're interacting with. And then why that spiritual dimension is actually critical, even if you're an atheist, even if you think it's all woo, that's fine. The reality you've got to grapple with is that most people out there have some sort of spirituality, and you've got to take that into account, because otherwise you won't understand why your message isn't getting through.
I'm not sure atheists actually don't think that they're, whilst I don't think they discredit in terms of not saying that it's because they disagree with it, I don't think they accept that there would be, I'm trying to, I'm messing this up. You said something about basically because they don't believe it's out that there is a religion or anything like that. I think they respect other people's entitlement to that view.
Yeah, it's not.
They're just a polar opposite to it.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's not that they don't.
It's a minority on a global scale. It's like it's less than 10% of the planet.
Mm.
But I don't.
I didn't mean to get the wrong impression. It's not that they don't respect it or anything like that. I mean, some don't, but that's fine. They're entitled to that view.
Yeah.
You know? Some of it's not respectable. You know, like I'm not a big fan of, you know, Aztec child sacrifice, for example. But
no.
So,
you're not a big fan.
Write that down.
How much of a fan are you of Aztec child sacrifice?
Yeah, but I suppose what I'm saying is why it's important is because if I've seen some really interesting stuff written on the way that the assumption of secularism can make us blind to where a lot of other people are coming from. It happens in diplomacy, happens in NGOs, happens in all kinds of things. Yeah, we don't even see some issues because we don't even have the right questions or don't know enough about a particular religion or culture to know that something might be affecting them. Like one of the big problems of the US has got, to a lesser extent, the white ring of Australia, but you know, the US has got a big problem where you've got tens of millions of fundamentalist Christians who believe that the world has to get bad because then Jesus is going to come back. That's their real view. So this climate, this stuff is impenetrable to that worldview because firstly, they only believe the world's 10,000 years old anyway, and so then Jesus is going to come back and rescue us. So that's a real thing, and it's like tens of millions of people, you know, marginal congressional seats and senators.
See, that to me is more scary than climate change.
And me, but this is
they'll all vote Donald Trump.
So I suppose I'm just saying, so understanding the religious worldviews that we're enmeshed in is really important.
Yeah, I just had a conversation a while ago with somebody. He's a theologian, academic, lecturer in international development, similar sort of background. I see him every week. He's someone I cross up on here with. But I tend not to go too deep into some of these things because I'm going to drown in nanoseconds when I start getting into it. But he would sort of touch on this sort of stuff as well.
Yeah. And one thing I've noticed as well, at the other end, I interact with the whole. You know, a lot of hippies and kind of conscious types. One of the things who you'd think would be naturally affinitive to a lot of this sort of earth environmental stuff, and a lot of them are, but a lot of them have also absorbed a spirituality which is hyper-individualistic, anti-science, so they're very often very strongly anti-vaccination as well, but also there are streams of Buddhism and Hinduism which basically believe the world's an illusion, and so this stuff isn't real. Yeah, it doesn't matter. What's important is me and my trip and my personal bliss and my family. But that's the point of life. That's the point of spirituality. So understanding some of that stuff and how to engage with it and why our messages might be just hitting a brick wall is really important.
You can't complain that it's not something a little different. Can you? From charts of 500 million years ago temperature through to the Dalai Lama and all points in between. Mm. And I did ask the question last week, and I haven't said it this week, what isn't about sustainability? Well, the answer is everything is, because it's everything from our worldviews and our spirituality. And of course, if you're a systems thinker, this is where I came to it in a sense, if you're a systems thinker, you realise we are all connected, whether we like it or not. That while we've sat in this room, we don't have to be in the room, but while we have sat in the room, we've all, passed out materials which all of us have breathed in. We are a living example of a system, because actually we're just subsystems of a larger system, of a larger system, of a larger system.
We're part of the matrix.
Whether you want to call that spirituality, whether you want to call it something else, I don't know. But they all somehow interface there. A quieter presentation than loudmouth, that's me, and
fat tail. Thank you. You will be remembered. Can we thank Brett? I'm only stopping to look.